And welcome to a new episode. I'm your host, Alexander Hanning. Today we have a professor from Columbia Business School, a best-selling author, and she is ranked among the top management thinkers in the world. And she has even been ranked number one in strategy on Thinkers 50. Welcome, Rita McGrath.
A pleasure to be here.
And as I started saying, you've been ranked number one in strategy. So this question might seem silly, but what is strategy?
Well, strategy to me is the way I formally define it. It's a central integrated concept of how we're going to achieve our objectives. And each word there matters. So central means it's widely shared, means we're all aligned around, broadly speaking, what it is we're going to do. Integrated means we have consistent choices. So if our strategy is to be a super luxury provider, right, we're not going to have leftover vendor chairs in our waiting rooms the way that a Walmart would. So integrated, the pieces all work together. Concept, and this is what makes it hard because strategies basically are ideas and they've got to be transmitted human brain to human brain. And as a consequence, there's a lot of room for misinterpretation. So the fact that it's a concept implies that leaders have to spend a lot of time on communication. And then the how. And I think very often people get really confused about the difference between the goals that they set and how they're going to achieve those goals. So you'll see strategy statements all the time, which is like, our goal is to be the number one player in, you know, X geography. Okay, you know, if that's your strategy, right, what's your approach to getting there? How are you going to do that? Is it by being low cost? Is it by being highly differentiated? Is it by being most customer intimate? Is it by being most digitally advanced? You know, there's lots of different ways to get to that goal. And I think good strategies inform your choices about how you're going to do that. What people also forget about strategy is any clear strategy implies things you're going to do, but it also implies things you're not going to do. And being as clear about that is also essential.
And I think this is so important because the reason I started with this question is that like you said, there's so much strategy that it's not a strategy. Company says, we're going to be the number one company in our field. Great. But how does that help me as an employee making choices? Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a big problem, especially in large corporations, is actually communication. Mm-hmm. So that every employee in the company knows what to do.
Right.
And do you feel this is the case that all the employees in a big company knows what to do?
Most of the time, no. You know, the thing that seems incredibly clear to the people at the boardroom table gets devolved into complete confusion at the operating level. And what's even worse is a lot of times the operating level people feel that the boardroom people have no idea what's really going on. And so there creeps in this distrust, this sense of, you know, I'm going to do what I know is the right thing to do because they don't understand, you know. And so you get this lack of alignment all through the organization.
And that takes us to another topic, and that is, how well does management know what's actually going on in the company?
It varies by management. Some really know. I mean, I think the exceptional business leaders have a very close grip on the pulse of the organization. So, you know, legendary leaders like Sam Walton would go right into the store, and he would go first, before he'd go into one of his own stores, he'd go into the store across the street and he'd look at what they were charging for milk. And he'd go into his own store. And if the price for milk wasn't at or below the price that the competitor was charging, that store manager would hear about it from Walton himself. Herb Kelleher famously would spend time with the baggage handlers, would spend time with the people doing the things. The Best Buy CEO was famous for going right back into the stock room and talking to what they call the blue shirts, the people that do the service. And famously at town halls, he would ask for feedback from anybody, and people, you know, junior people, new hires would raise their hands and say, you know, I think there's a problem here, and we have to address it. And creating that environment where people are unafraid to bring you news, you know, whether it's positive or negative, and where you can actually get out to where the action is, I think is critical. And the best companies institutionalize this to some extent. So they have practices, right, that reinforce this. So one of my favorites was when Jim Bailey was building the credit card business at Citigroup. He had a weekly meeting with his senior leaders. And at a dedicated portion of the meeting, about 10 or 15 minutes, was always set aside to go around the table and say, okay, I want to hear one thing you heard that was interesting from a customer this week. And it didn't have to be good. It didn't have to be bad. Just one thing that was interesting. And by the way, your buddies at the country club don't count. And so what that did, because they knew they were going to get asked that every week, and it got kind of competitive, right? And so they knew they had to be out in the stores, out on the streets, interacting with regular credit card people, and they would work all week to get this nugget to bring back. And many of those nuggets turned into things that became part of the strategic plan.
And in your newest book, Seeing Around Corners, you have an example from Gap and a manager visiting a store. Can you tell us that story?
Well, this was a completely unintended observation by a reporter. And the ostensible purpose of this article was to talk about why retail leaders were not giving their workers more predictable hours. And the Gap had been very public about its intention to try to do that. So give people hours they could count on and they could have a living living wage. And it wasn't working well. And so this reporter wanted to find out why and went to interview all these store managers. And one of the store managers said, oh, you know, part of my big problem is these executive visits. Like these guys come up and I must have had my whole crew on double and triple overtime for the last 3 weeks getting ready for this visit. And I'm thinking to myself, what a rolling disaster, right? So here's this executive who in their mind, I'm sure is thinking they're doing the right thing. They're going to go out and do store visits. They're going to connect with customers. And yet the store they're going into probably has 3-4 times the labor hours in it as a regular store that you or I would walk into. And so, of course, they come away with the impression that there's no problem. One of my other favorite stories was, this is years and years ago, I was teaching at Columbia's facility up in Harriman, New York, which we don't have anymore, but we were there at the time. And there was a young man from T-Mobile there. And back in the day, like the T-Mobile network was like the worst network in the United States. It was just terrible. And T-Mobile was a subsidiary of the German parent company, Deutsche Telekom. And he was telling me over lunch or something that, oh yeah, you know, one of his big execs is going to come here and he's going to do this big tour of the facilities and they're going to visit him and they're going to have all these meetings and everything. And I looked at him and I said, well, what are you going to do about the fact that when he gets here, like it's not going to work the way it does at home? And he looked at me and he said, oh, that won't be a problem. We know all of his, you know, scheduled stops. We know his travel schedule. We know everybody he's going to be meeting with. And we've got the guys out there right now making sure that the network is perfect for this guy's visit. True story.
So that means that management think they see the reality, but they don't. They're like insulated. And I mean, like as a single person being on top of a big corporation, there's no physical way for you to know everything going on in your corporation. That's just the way it is. But I think the problem is, as you say, it's much worse than CEOs think, that they're not getting a true view of the company until maybe it's too late.
Oh, the lack of understanding on the part of CEOs of what actually happens in their company blows my mind. So here's a current example, which my friend Zeynep Tan uses. And I'm talking CEOs of companies that employ lots of low paid workers. They have no idea how little those workers are paid. They just don't know. And they'll say things like, oh, we pay at market benchmark. Well, if market benchmark is 20% below what it takes you to live, that's not a very good standard, right? And I think that bleeds into all these other things, right? So we don't pay those workers very much because they're not very good workers. Well, guess what? You know, if you're working two jobs because you can't afford to live on one, and you're worried about how you're going to put food on the table, and you've got all these mounting insecurities at home, you're not going to be a great worker. You're just not. And so I think we misunderstand so much of the way organizations work, that it's very easy to get insulated. The other thing that happens to senior people a lot is they end up talking to people just like themselves, and they end up talking to the same comfortable circle all the time. And it's very dangerous.
And that takes me to another thing, and that is companies going into new markets and making a strategy to go and open a new business line so often fails.
Oh, yeah.
What's the reason for that?
Well, in the case of new markets, there tends to be the assumption that the new market's going to behave the way the old one did, or the way the existing ones did. And two famous examples of that are when Disney opened up in Europe. So you have to go back and think about the history here. So Walt Disney, the man, conceived of the Disney theme park in California. And everybody said, you people are crazy. Disneyland. You people are crazy. Who's going to want to stand out in the hot California sun waiting to buy Mickey Mouse hats? That's nuts. And it was a tremendous success. And then they moved to Florida and they opened up Disney World in Florida. And everybody at the time said, you people are crazy. You know, there's nothing in Orlando but like alligators and sand. And you want to put this international theme park there? You're nuts. And then this is people now think they went straight to Europe. They didn't. They went to Japan. And again, people said, you people are nuts. I mean, this theme park, you can actually see it from the highway as you're traveling from the airport to the city. You can see the beautiful Disney turrets. And it was a huge success. Huge success. So by the time they get to Europe, you could forgive them for thinking they knew what they were doing. And yet, what they failed to take into account was that Europeans behave very differently than Americans do, or that Japanese do, for that matter. So both Americans and Japanese are snacking cultures. Like we spend all day long shoving stuff into our mouths. We graze and we drink and we eat in our cars and all that kind of thing. They're grazing cultures. So, you know, you can have a theme park with food service all day long. They don't do that in Europe. In Europe, everybody troops in and sits down for lunch for an hour or two. And if it's France, which this was, they're used to drinking wine with their lunch. And it's a festive, relaxed, time-consuming occasion. Well, they hadn't built a park which was suitable for that. So you have this inability to really understand why a culture looks so different when it seems to be the same on the surface. And you've got all this success to explain it. Another great example is Walmart going into Germany. And Walmart banged away at Germany for like 12 years before finally throwing up their hands in defeat. Because in America, you can get away with offering cheap products to get people in the door. And then being Americans, we go around the store with our shopping cart and we just throw everything willy-nilly in. And our mental calculators are not actually that great. And so we figure, it's a basket full of stuff. That's fine. Germans? No. I mean, take my grandmother as an example. She would go to 6 different stores to get the least expensive item on her shopping list addressed. Like the time value of money did not exist for her relative to the money value of money. And when you've got a whole culture that's designed around that behavior, that classic tried and true Walmart model isn't going to work.
And your grandmother being German, that is. That's fascinating. So how come big companies make, what's the reason they go into this market and fail so badly? What do they do wrong when they make their strategy or doing their plan? Sure.
Well, there's a classic pattern to this, which is untested assumptions, which are taken as facts. Very few opportunities for low commitment tests. We make a decision, we're going to do this, damn it. Typically large budget, large staff, right at the beginning, before you even know what you're doing. A plan that you've now socialized it, right? You've sold it to the board, you've sold it to your board of directors, you've sold it to the senior team, you've gotten the budget for it, your CFO's bought off on it, and that's the plan, and you're going to go execute the plan as though you had data, and you don't. And so what ends up happening is there's this whole political, we're going to do this, right, that starts to happen. And even though people in their heart of hearts, they know they don't know what they're doing, the cost of admitting that at the moment seems much higher than the cost of just plowing forward and hoping you'll figure it out in market. I literally have a client at the moment, a consulting client that's launching a venture, and I'm in there with my colleague asking all these questions about, have you validated product market fit? Have you figured out, you know, who actually is going to need this thing? Have you done any A/B testing with respect to price? And all these questions, which they're finding very uncomfortable. And their position is, we just want to launch it and then we'll fix any problems once it's in the market. And I'm like, that's going to cost you thousands of times more than doing some simple tests up front, but they don't want to do it. And it's fascinating, the resistance I'm getting. It's like, no, we've got the plan. We're executing the plan. As though, you know, you couldn't see from a mile away, this thing is going to be a complete flaming disaster. And I put that in writing and sent it to them because it's clear they've not done their homework and they don't want to do their homework.
And you made 2 examples here with Walmart going to Germany and Disneyland going into Europe and to Paris. I heard rumors you have a list.
Oh, I do. I've got a whole file.
Tell us about the list.
I call it my flops file. It's not just, it's more than a list. It's an entire encyclopedia. What I do is I collect case studies of ventures that have just gone grievously wrong. And there are lots. I'll give you some recent examples. Quibi, which blew $2 billion, basically proving that millennials aren't interested in 10-minute high-quality movies. DrinkWorks, which was a sort of a love child between Anheuser-Busch and Keurig, the coffee pot people. And Anheuser-Busch wanted to grow into new markets, and Keurig wanted something that would, you know, like be an addition to their pod business. And so here was the solution. We're going to make these cocktail pods. And so it's going to be coffee pods in the morning and cocktail pods at night. And they launched it in 2017. They went national in 2020. 2021, I want to say, they just announced a whole new suite of products. They were well on their way to this national launch. And then December of 2021, without any notice, somebody pulled the plug and just said, we're shutting it down. And my personal hypothesis about that is somebody must have sat down and said, hang on, let us do a little math and figure out how many of these cocktail pods it's going to take for us to sell to actually make sense for two companies the size of Keurig and Anheuser-Busch. And it would be like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of pods. Just not a business they should do. Another one that I love was Zillow. You may know Zillow. They're like they keep track of house prices and stuff. They're a very high-tech real estate, basically, firm. And they had this hypothesis that their algorithms would allow them to price homes more intelligently than somebody who was just a broker on the street could. And so they went into the home flipping business. And it was a disaster because it turns out your neighbor, you know, who knows a lot more about the barking dog and the landfill that's about to be set up in your town than you do, is actually much more able to calculate what your house is really worth than you are with an algorithm. And I could go on. There's dozens of them.
It's fascinating, though. I mean, and as we talked on the previous episode you were in, like, these are smart people, and they're investors pouring in billions of dollars into these companies, and still they get it so wrong and to lose so much money. Mm-hmm. By the way, how much do you need to lose to get on your list?
$50 million.
$50 million. Okay,
so to listeners, $50 million. I'm not even going to bother looking at the smaller ones.
Yeah. So to the listeners, you know, you might screw up, but don't screw up at $50 million or more, because then you'll end up with this list.
You know, there's one that's playing out right now, which is the whole cryptocurrency thing. So I don't know if you followed, it was today's headlines of all these high-powered celebrities, you know, advertising, oh, get into crypto or you're going to miss the moment, right? It appears that 96 to 99% of the value of all those underlying assets has just gone poof, and they're pulling their ads astonishingly.
Yeah, it's a disaster. And I'm sure, I'm a technologist of my studies, and I truly believe in the technology behind, you know, the blockchain and everything. But it's just, this is the feeling I get from, I was part of the dot-com bust, you know, the dot-com boom and then the bust. And the way we talked about Web 1.0 is kind of the same we talk about Web 1.3 now. I mean, like, there's going to be an Amazon there, but, you know, most of the pets.com and everything else went bankrupt, but there's, you know, there's some nuggets there that's going to be big at, you know, in the future, but it's hard to pick now.
There will be. And I think that's one of the reasons that people keep pouring money into these things, is that it is long odds of huge success, but most of the time it's not going to work out. And that's okay. I'm fine with a lot of things not working out, but just don't not work out expensively. You cannot work out cheaply.
that's a good example. So Rita, I actually saw you on stage in Oslo many years ago, and you had a beautiful example of a new CEO starting at Ford Motor Company. Can you tell me that story?
Sure. So this was Alan Mulally, who had been a rising star at Boeing, and basically ran every new aircraft business for five or six generations of Boeing aircraft. So really, really skilled guy. And Ford, the man, the family owner who was CEO at the time, approached him and asked, would he be willing to come to Ford and basically saved this American icon. And Alan wasn't so sure, but at the same time, he rose to the challenge and arrives at Ford. And so his first day at Ford, he gets driven to the executive parking garage at the Ford Motor Company. And he looks around and beholds no Ford branded cars in the executive parking garage at the Ford Motor Company. It was all these like exotic, foreign, different brands, you know, Range Rover and stuff that they owned at the time. But it made it clear that none of the executives were actually buying the product, which is a pretty big warning sign. Now, Ford at the time had a very toxic executive culture. So your enemy was not General Motors. No, no, no. Your enemy was the guy down the hall that you were vying for the next promotion with. So it was a very toxic, internally competitive, like, I withhold information, I don't share. And Alan has nothing to do with any of that. He's all about, you know, one team, one goal, one objective. And one of his most famous practices is a weekly meeting, which he calls the business plan review meeting. And the idea behind it is to create alignment. And so you have all the heads of the operating divisions there, as well as the support staff. So, you know, North America, Asia, South America, and the product side. And then on the support side, legal, HR, IT, da, da, da. So it's kind of a matrix. And everybody's there. And they have their goals for the week in a single page PowerPoint. And it's every goal is coded with a color. So green is got it, you know, meeting my plan. Yellow is not meeting my plan, but I kind of know what I'm going to do, and you know, if I need help, I'll reach out. Red is not meeting my plan, don't know what I'm going to do, and this is problematic. Well, of course, the first problem he runs into is none of the executives want to come to his meeting. They have people that do that, right? And they don't want to produce their own performance data because that's what their chiefs of staff and stuff does. And Alan's like, no. Look, if you don't want to come to my meeting, that's okay. You know, and when Alan, says, that's okay, like the little hairs on the back of the book, because it's a sure sign that something is very much not okay. He says, that's okay. Like, you can't be a member of the senior leadership team of the Ford Motor Company as long as I'm CEO if you don't come to my meeting, but it doesn't mean you're a bad person. Get the idea? Okay, so First meeting, they all sort of shuffle in, and nobody wants to be there except Alan, right? And he knows he's got a big team building challenge ahead of him. And they've got all the numbers on the table in front of them, and it's all green. Now, That wouldn't be such a bad thing, except that a few days before, Alan had had a very serious heart-to-heart with the CFO, who said Ford that year was on track to lose close to $17 billion, with a B. Like, that's a lot of money, even for a great big company. And they were in deep, dark trouble. They were really headed for kind of an extinction event. And so Alan's looking at this table full of people. His jaw drops in astonishment. He says, Is it our plan to lose $17 billion? Because if it is, we're right on track. And he said something that stuck with me forever. He said, you know, you can't manage a secret. Like, if we can bring up the problems, you know, see what's going on, we can fix it. But if it's just hidden somewhere in the organization, we can't do anything about it. And so this goes on a couple of weeks. And then finally, Mark Fields, who became CEO when Alan retired, he says, all right, I think I've got one of these red things Alan's talking about. I'm red on Edge. Now, the Edge was a small SUV that Ford had been counting on to fulfill its promise of a complete product line up and down the Ford brand. And they had the dealers lined up to promote it. They'd set aside advertising money. They had, you know, everybody pumped up and ready to go. They had sales plans. They had all this stuff. And Mark has just said there's a manufacturing problem. And to do the right thing, right, which was not to release a poor quality vehicle, but to release only a vehicle that met their quality standards, he'd stop the production line. And he didn't know what the problem was yet. And the room goes completely quiet. All heads snap to Alan, like, because, and what he does in the next, 3 seconds is going to determine whether they believe him about this red, green, yellow thing. And so what does he do? He stands up, applauds. Great transparency, Mark. All right, let's stop the meeting for a sec. Anybody got any ideas? And after, you know, a couple of seconds, one person sort of says, well, here's what we might do about the advertising thing. Here's a thought about how we might handle the dealers. A person who is on the production side said, I've got two engineers. I had a problem similar to that. I'll fly them out to you this afternoon. You know, within about 4 minutes, they had about 80% of the solution to that problem architected. Now, it wasn't solved yet. It took a while. But working together, they were able to come up with that because genuinely in the room were talented people with expertise. And when Alan changed the political environment in that place and made it about working together rather than competing with each other, it allowed all that energy and talent to emerge.
Well, that's a great story. And it shows also when you get alignment, like taking back to the start, like if you have a strategy that everybody understands and it's communicated clearly, so everybody knows what to do, and then people can, you know, get aboard and help each other. Because if not, if everybody's confused about the strategy, they will only focus on their own goals, right?
Which is perfectly rational.
Yeah, definitely. But it's not the optimal solution by far.
Not at all.
So Rita, the listener here finds out that he or she needs a new strategy for the company and wanted to use best practices. Is there a book or online resource you can direct them to?
Well, I'm very partial to my own work on that subject. So the most recent strategy book I've written is called The End of Competitive Advantage. And there's a lot of sort of ideas there about how you can think about strategy today. I think the temptation is to reach out to experts, which is not a bad thing, but just don't outsource your thinking, right? So I think what I like to do is I like to break people into teams, and I like them to focus on 5 C's for the analytical part. So the first C is your customer. Second C is your complementary relationships. Third C is your competitor. Fourth C is your company and its own capabilities. And then the fifth C is context. And what I like to do is give people some workbooks and worksheets and then some free time. They need to have time to do this work, but to have them actually do the strategy work and then come together and share the insights that they've learned. And what you'll find is it builds capability. And so what I like to take people through is the analytical part, which is the five C's. Then we come together and say, well, what are our options? What are our choices? And, you know, your best strategy is only as good as your best choice. So be expansive in your set of choices. Then have some criteria that allows you to determine what the best one is. Then you pick your strategy, your winning proposition, that core central idea. Then you think about what has to happen in the organization to deliver that idea. You have some gaps that you develop that you can then close. And then you think about, okay, what would a portfolio, a supporting resource portfolio, look like that would support that structure, that strategy, that set of choices? And stop doing anything that doesn't fit. Start doing things that do. And then you can think of it as almost like a continuous cycle. And so that's how I like to do it for real when I'm doing it with companies. You know, some people feel very pressured, like, oh, I'm not expert in this. You don't have to be. You can start something. You can start small. And then if you need the support of, you know, a strategy consultancy or somebody who's got deep expertise, I think that's great. But do enough of the work that you're not at their mercy. You know, have your own point of view on your future.
And when you come up with this really good strategy, how do you communicate that to get everyone involved in understanding strategy? Do you have any tips for that?
Well, I think there's no substitute for people feeling they've had the ability to have input. So one of my all-time favorite stories about this, and it's an old one now, but I think it illustrates the theme, is you may remember back in the 80s and 90s, Jack Welch was like this hero of the business school world, right? And right around the time in the early 80s when he was reshaping GE, so what he inherited was this classic conglomerate. With, I think it was 16 lines of business and verticals, right, and very specific about industries. And that was created by a thing called the McKinsey Matrix, which was, you know, attractive positions in attractive industries, la, 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 la. So he rethought this and he said, okay, what I want to do is focus this giant sprawling company on three areas. And he drew this sheet of paper, handwritten, and I can get you a copy if you want to visually show your readers. But so it was core business. These are businesses that are good businesses today. They're going to be good businesses for the future. We want to keep it to those. Then we've got high tech, which is things like aircraft engines, because, you know, the high tech business of today is the core business of tomorrow. So we want to be there. And then services. As the world is moving more towards services, we need GE to be playing in that. And so he drew these three circles. And then he listed the businesses he perceived to be in and out. And so that was where we're going to compete. And then how we're going to compete is the famous number one or number two in every market that we serve. We're going to lead with technology and we're going to be the most customer responsive entity in that space, right? One sheet of paper, very plain. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because I was in a class that Don Hambrick was leading. He was one of my colleagues at Columbia at the time. And he was telling me with enormous pride how he had been at the meeting where Jack Welch revealed this strategy on this handwritten sheet of paper. You know, it was still tentative. He was still mulling it over. He was looking to get feedback. And Don was like, I was one of the people he asked for feedback. That was amazing. And so I was having lunch or something with my mentor at Wharton, Ian McMillan, who's this very gruff South African guy, doesn't mince his words. And I said to him, he was very impressed by this. Did you know, like, that Don Hambrick was at the meeting where Welch revealed, you know, this thing? And Mac looks at me. He was a little cruder than I was, but he said, the hell he was. I was at the meeting where Jack Welch, you know. And so we started to ask around among all of our business school colleagues, and we are convinced he ran that meeting 150 times. He knew where he wanted to take the strategy. It was all there. It was all clear. What he was looking for was buy-in. And it was handwritten. I'm looking for your input. Tell me how, you know, tell me where I'm wrong. Tell me what I need to do. Now, I knew him well enough to say, if someone had raised a critical flaw, he would have listened. But most of that activity was not to get critical flaw, it was to get critical buy-in. It's a great story.
Wow, that's a great story. And I think it's so important, like, as a leader, you get sick of, like, repeating the same message over and over again. You think everybody heard this a million times before the single individual or single employee. That might be the first time.
Oh, totally.
So I think just, you know, repeating the same simple message often and often is so important.
It is.
Or else you get, you know, like a million different version of what he or she said, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, David Patrick, who used to be the CEO of Charles Schwab's, had a 700 time rule. He said, I don't believe anybody's heard my message till I repeat it 700 times. And he says, you know, I'll be there and it's time number 673. I am bored to death. I can't believe anybody still needs to hear this. And there'd be some guy in the back of the room going, oh, that's what you meant.
No, but it's true though, and it's so important because it saves so much time for everyone if there's one clear message of what we're, you know, what are we, where are we heading, how are we getting there, what are we supposed to do and not to.
Exactly.
So thank you for sharing all these insights about strategy, Rita, and being on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I really enjoyed meeting you and getting to meet your listeners.